The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Well, good morning and welcome to Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield Community Radio. Also listening to us on 88.1 WSBR in Lee, Lennox, and Stockbridge. Watching the PCTV Select app and possibly over on Access Pittsfield Channel 1301 on your cable dial. Sean Sear here with you this morning. Glad that you're along for the ride on Thursday, April 30th, the last day of April. We have reached that point, and we're headed into May tomorrow, amazingly. And we look outside, and it feels like an April day out there today. A little bit of kind of drizzle and gray skies, but the green leaves are popping out, and we're starting to see some real evidence of spring out there. So that's what we're headed into. Got a great show here for you this morning. John Dixon joins me in just a moment. He is the author of Herman Melville in the Berkshires, a new book about Herman Melville and his time here in Pittsfield, and lots more. We're going to talk to John all about that upcoming here in the show. So stick around. All of that is coming. First, we want to get to our weather forecast and let you know what's coming up over the next 24, 36 hours or so. Here we go.
WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Rest of tonight, rain. Near steady temperature in the mid-40s. South wind 5 to 10 miles per hour with gusts up to 25 miles per hour. Chance of rain 90%. Thursday, mostly cloudy. Showers likely, mainly in the morning. Cooler with highs in the mid-50s. South wind 5 to 10 miles per hour with gusts up to 20 miles per hour, becoming west in the afternoon. Chance of rain 60%. Thursday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers in the evening, then partly cloudy after midnight. Lows in the upper 30s. Northwest wind 5 to 10 miles per hour with gusts up to 20 miles per hour. Chance of rain 30%. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
All right, there you go. I do hear that we are going to get a little bit of a cold snap. Not snap, we don't call it a snap in spring, but it's going to be a little colder over the next couple days in the 50s, where we were kind of expecting some 60s and 70s, but, you know, not terrible. And then a little bit of a warm-up after that. Probably as soon as the weekend's over, it'll get nicer. That's the way it usually works in the Berkshires. So before we get to our guest here this morning, I do want to remind people that just 1 week from today, we have our big PCTV Eats a Pizza event. I'll hold up the flyer here for our television viewers. You'll see this around and on Facebook and things like that. It's happening Thursday, May 7th, 2026 at 6 p.m. over at Berkshire Hills Country Club in Pittsfield. There are drawings, music, and of course, lots of pizza. So you'll get to decide who has the best pizza in Berkshire County while supporting your community media stations like WTBR and PCTV. The restaurants will be featuring Papa Joe's Ristorante, Riverside Public House, Zuko's Family Restaurant, The Locker Room, Shire Tavern, and Papa John's. We appreciate their support, and they're good sports about it, and the wonderful, wonderful pizza all night. Also proudly sponsored by the folks at Cohen, Kinney, Valicenti, and Cook, and David and Marita Glott. So we want to thank them. If you want to get tickets for that event, you can visit pittsfieldtv.org/pizza. That's pittsfieldtv.org/pizza for more information and for your tickets. We appreciate all of your support for this community media station. This is one of our big ones, so love to have a bunch of people come out and enjoy themselves and support our organization at the same time. All right. Welcome to the show. And John Dixon, good morning to you, sir. How are you?
I'm great, Sean. Thanks so much. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing okay for the early morning. I'm not a morning person. I talk about that all the time. But I get here somehow, and we have great conversations. Yeah. So it's a lot of fun. So you have written a book. This is, and I'll hold it up right here for our TV viewers again, Herman Melville in the Berkshires, John S. Dixon, published by the History Press. Let's talk about how you came to write a book about Herman Melville. What in your life experiences and your time here in the Berkshires led you to be so interested in this person who we all know, anyone from the Berkshires and from Pittsfield knows that Herman Melville has this strong connection to Pittsfield?
Well, I'm a little embarrassed to start off with that. it took me 30 years of coming to the Berkshires before I actually set foot in the building. We would drive by it. My wife grew up in Pittsfield, and I would come visit her family. And I read Moby Dick as right out of college. Mm. It was a tough read. And then when I retired, I ended up over there at the Historical Society, which owns and operates and manages Arrowhead, and asked to do some volunteer work, and they put me right to work, and that was 2013. And at that point, I dug in, and I call it the Melville hook. It hooked me, and I went down deep. so I've been doing tours there for a long time. Mm-hmm. And what happened was on the tour, the tour ends up in the study, and you're looking at Mount Greylock, and we make the case that Melville was writing Moby Dick and looked at Greylock, and he saw a white whale, and that inspired him. But gradually over the years, as I walked around, I like to hike in the Berkshires, and as I continued to read other Melville books, I saw the Berkshires in a lot of his writing. And it was more and more obvious that there's something that has been untapped. That's, people know about Melville and the oceans and his trips in the ocean, but they don't know that and don't really haven't dug into his wanderings in the Berkshires and how it made its way into his stories, even in the ocean stories. I mean, the Berkshires is in Moby Dick. So,
and again, you wouldn't think of a place that's kind of a landlocked place having that much of a presence in a novel mostly about the sea.
And that novel is mostly about the sea, but he's writing it sitting here in the Berkshires, and he goes out for walks every day, and I'll give you an example. He looks at a tree as he's walking, and the tree's lying on the ground, and he sees a whale, and he writes about a beached whale that looks like a fallen tree with, one of the limbs is its eye socket, and he writes about, he throws in the ice glen in Stockbridge. That he sees a beached whale on his voyage, and Ishmael sees the beached whale, and behind it is foliage that's as verdant as the ice glen. Well, nobody knows outside of Stockbridge what the ice glen is, but Melville did. And so he threw it in there. So he's grabbing things.
We would call that an Easter egg today, right?
that may not. He sees the connections that the rest of us, me especially, don't see, and he makes those connections and he tucks them away and plugs them in his novels as he's writing.
And give us a little perspective on when you first read Moby Dick. It was part of your life where you were on the road as well, right?
Yes, and a little of the book is my own experience with Melville and Moby Dick and the Berkshires. I call this, just aside, I call this my love letter to the Berkshires. And a lot of Melville's writing, too, is a love letter to the Berkshires. But my own, again, I'm embarrassed to say that I was assigned to read it in college, and I skipped class that week. I had other projects I was trying to finish, and I grabbed the book and put it in my duffel bag and said, I'm going to read this while I'm in the Peace Corps. And so during the torrential rainstorms of the equatorial forest, when you couldn't go outside, I sat.
Where were you? What country
I was
were
in
you
Gabon, in? Central Africa, as an English teacher.
And the Peace Corps, so right after college.
Right after college. So I grabbed six or seven books with me, and I knew this one would keep me occupied quite a while, but it was only a week because it was raining so hard, and I had nothing else to do.
Yeah, there wasn't the internet, right? You didn't have a smartphone with you to keep you busy.
No. And on the tours, I ask people, this is one book that when you're reading it, you remember where you were. And a lot of people will point exactly to where they were when they finished the book, what they were doing. Mm. So you don't do that with a lot of books, but this one is. Stephen Colbert said, you're almost like Ahab chasing the white whale. You're chasing the end of this book. You're so obsessed. But
And that was kind of the theme of that, right?
Yeah.
So talk about, let's rewind a little bit on Herman Melville and talk about his early life and what it was like. Just before we went on air, you said, well, he was actually a city kid.
He's a city boy. He grew up, he was born right at the tip of southern Manhattan. He came from a prestigious family. His father was a Revolutionary War hero, Boston, Major Thomas Melville, and very wealthy. And he had two sons, and Herman was born into a wealthy family. And the father went through his wealth. He ran an export-import business that failed at a time when they were raising tariffs to protect American industry.
And not every business succeeded back then, right? There were no safety nets or anything like that. If your father had a problem in business and he failed and he had debts, there were going to be consequences.
Debtor's prison. Mm. And so they fled back to Albany, where his mother was from. Mm. And it was when he was a 12-year-old in Albany that he and his mother and his father and one sister, he had seven siblings, they came out to Pittsfield because his uncle, his father's lone brother, lived at the Pittsfield, what we now know as the Country Club of Pittsfield. Huh.
But before it was a golf course, it was actually the family estate?
Family estate, and it was initially a farm owned by another great Pittsfield resident who introduced was the first agricultural fair in the country.
And who was that?
Yeah, I was afraid you were going to ask me.
Was it Watson?
Yes.
Okay.
He raised Merino sheep there. Yeah. And
that's another big story for Pittsfield, right?
Yes.
I mean, that was explored quite a bit during, I think, the 150th of Pittsfield, and they talked about the Merino sheep and how important that was for industry and for farming and agriculture. Everything here in Pittsfield was the Merino sheep.
And principally because the very hard to farm. So you could do sheep grazing, and then all of a sudden the mills needed all the wool, and so it was a nice interaction between the agricultural and the new industry. But Melville came out, this city boy, he had been grown up in New York City, gone to great schools, went to Albany Academy in Albany, but then came out here. You can imagine looking at green space and mountains and lakes. There's, lake right on the farm. And his cousin...
And that would have been Morwood Lake, right?
That would have been Melville Lake at the time.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But with the people who bought the farm from the Melvilles, the Morwoods, changed the name, and it's been Morwood Lake ever since.
Interesting.
So I'm trying to imagine, I was 10 or 11 years old the first time I saw the ocean. Taken aback, and I loved it right away. And I think Melville, when he saw this, his cousin said Herman's first love was the Berkshire farm. And he came back summer after summer. He was working at the time. He had to drop out of school because his father died.
What age would that have been?
He dropped out of school at 12.
Oh, wow.
So this man who writes these difficult books had a sixth grade education.
Wow. Right? So was he self-taught?
He was self-taught. He had an older brother who did go through high school and ended up being a lawyer and who would write down lists of books. Here, Herman, we got to read these. This is what it means to become a learned gentleman. But at the same time, Melville loved coming out, helping his uncle on the farm. And one summer at age 17, he managed the farm when his uncle went out to Illinois. And he stayed here and taught school up on October Mountain. But wasn't called October Mountain at the time because he gave the name October Mountain to October Mountain because of the colors he could see from Arrowhead in the fall. He taught school for a semester and he didn't like it. And so there was a long gap when he went from 17 to roughly 30, almost 30, when he was at sea and writing books in New York City. Then he came back to visit his cousin at the farm when he was 28, and then again in the summer of 1850, and that's when he decided, as a 30-year-old, to move to the Berkshires with his whole family.
And the property at Arrowhead, was that connected to the farm over near where Pittsfield Country Club is now? Because it's all connected with the lake, right?
Well,
was it all one property?
No, it abuts, and it's a mirror image.
Mm-hmm.
It was a mirror image going all the way from, you know, between Route 7 and Holmes Road, mm-hmm. just like the country club property.
Yeah.
A little smaller. And, you know, when Melville came in the summer of 1850 for a visit and his cousin told him he sold the farm, I'm sure it pierced his heart. He would have tried everything he could to buy it, but he had to look around. He wanted to keep coming back. Mm-hmm.
So at that point, he was not a wealthy person by any means either, right?
No, but he was an established writer. He had written five books.
Mm-hmm.
The first book made him famous worldwide, or at least across the Atlantic.
And that book was called?
It was called Typee, and it was about his adventures in the Marquesas on a whaler, and he had jumped ship with a friend in the Marquesas. So
that's what he did, spending his time between his youth and 1850.
Fill that
in a little bit for us. What more did he do there?
So roughly at the age of 19, he got a berth on a merchant ship to Liverpool and back. But that was a short voyage,
mm-hmm.
and he enjoyed life at sea. He was thrown in with these rough and rowdy sailors. He saw himself as a gentleman, and he writes about that in a book called Redburn. But anyway, he comes back and he wanders around the United States, goes all the way out to Galena, Illinois, where his uncle had relocated from the Berkshire farm, leaving the farm in the care of his son. And he was looking for work, looking for adventure, kind of born to be wild, and couldn't find it. And so he came back and signed on to a whaling ship at the age of 21 in New Bedford.
Mm-hmm.
And he was at sea from that point on for almost 4 years.
Wow.
But he was jumping ship. He had incredible adventures. And he ended up in Hawaii and joining the U.S. Navy to get home. And so he writes a book about the U.S. Navy. And so his first five books were all sea books. And then he starts writing this book about whaling while he's in New York City. And he's almost finished when he comes up here that summer for a visit. And what happened that summer caused him to put that draft of a whaling book aside and start rewriting it as Moby Dick.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Huh. So he had the kernel of the idea before he came to Pittsfield.
I think and we don't know because Melville famously said, I have a vile habit of burning my letters. He didn't leave much of a trace. He wanted the books to stand and speak for themselves. But
yeah, I think in the book you say that he is sort of unknowable for some reasons. And one of the reasons was he didn't want those personal effects and letters and papers to last after him, right? He got rid of them.
And drafts.
Yeah, drafts of books.
Drafts of books. There's only one draft of a book that he wrote exists in about 20 pages of his first book. So he wanted the final product to speak for itself. But the draft that we do have is just, you know, you could see he's a heavy editor.
Is that right?
Yeah, and just rewriting and rewriting.
Hmm.
But
and that was at a time when we didn't have word processing, right? I mean, if you're rewriting something, it's all by hand. I don't think there were ballpoint pens at that point. I mean, it's wonderful to think and put yourself back in that time period where you were working with the technology and sort of the everything around you. You know, that was their existence and their life. So sort of set the stage for some of that. We sort of talked about that right before we went on air. No electricity, no telephones. Means of communication was the telegraph or telegram, right?
And letters.
And certainly letters.
A lot of letters.
Yeah. Transportation was basically limited to there were trains, longer range, right?
Mm-hmm.
But most people still got around by
horseback or walking.
Yeah.
And on the technology side, what he did have was sisters and a wife who served as his copyists, and so he would give them his drafts, because his handwriting was so terrible and he would edit so heavily. And they would copy. They would sit down. They were literate and literary women. And they would copy every word he wrote and he'd give it back to him. And he'd edit it again and give it back to them. And so that was his word processor. He's very willing. And I don't know how willing, but they did it over the course of many years of copying his work.
It wasn't a quick process, I would imagine.
No. No, it was a... Well, you know, he wrote... He started writing Moby Dick He started writing the Whaling Book in the spring of 1850. He started rewriting it in November when he moved into Arrowhead. And he published it a year later.
Wow. So actually, that's quicker than I would have thought.
Yeah. Quicker than I wrote this thin, skinny book, for sure, with a word processor. But... He writes to Hawthorne at one point saying, I need a half a dozen men to help me scrape this book off my brain. He's thinking so fast and wanting to get it out so quickly. It's just pouring out of his brain.
Yeah. John Dixon is my guest here if you're just tuning in to Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. We're talking about his newest book, Herman Melville in the Berkshires. He describes it as a thin book, but it's fascinating. There's a great story to be had there. Some of the story is woven around sort of theme of wandering. And we want to talk about, certainly about him writing Moby Dick during the time he was here in Pittsfield. But he was only here really lived at Arrowhead for 13 years out of his life. He lived from when to when? How old was he?
So he was 30 when he moved here, when he bought Arrowhead, and that was 1850. And he left in the middle of the Civil War in 1863 to move back to New York City. He tried his hand at a farming. He wanted to be a gentleman farmer, and it was just too hard to do both the writing that he wanted to be a writer and and have a farm, a viable farm, but he couldn't do both. He had a hired hand, but he was financially, he wasn't able to make ends meet. And, you know, his mother and his sisters were saying, oh, Herman's depressed, he can't. But he never said, as Hawthorne did. Hawthorne left after a year and a half and said, I hate the Berkshires. That pierced my heart when I read that. But then I read later on, Hawthorne hated everywhere he lived. But Melville himself never disparaged the Berkshires. He never disparaged his life here. His mother and his sister said, oh, he's not doing well here, he can't make it. But I think he left unwillingly, but realizing that he's not going to make it financially. And he went back to New York City and got a job working with U.S. Customs, a drone of a job, but he did it for 20 years, and he was financially firm, you know, at the end of his life.
Was he still writing at that point?
He had pretty much stopped his last... full novel was here, The Confidence Man. It was published in 1859 while he was here. And then he had started writing short stories here because he could sell those right to a magazine. They didn't have to wait for someone to buy the book.
But it was difficult, as I'm sure it is today, to make your sole living on writing. So some things don't change.
Especially without the copyright laws. And even Hawthorne had a hard time. Hawthorne, very successful writer, had to get a job as consul general in Liverpool to make a little money. But anyway, he started writing poetry in his last few years here. And he wrote poetry for the rest of his life. And then in retirement, he started writing Billy Budd. A short novel. So he never could not write. This is my feeling.
So let's talk about those last few years here in the Berkshire. So the Moby Dick at this point, in 1850, you said it was published 1851?
It was published in 1851.
Yeah.
And
So then does he go on to national fame and fortune from Moby Dick?
He went on to national fame from his first book.
Just from his first book. Yeah. So Moby Dick wasn't a huge splash, and I use that pun liberally, right? So it was out there. How was it received?
So it was problematic because the first publisher in England left out 70 pages, had a different title. And so when
What was the original title?
The original title was The Whale. And that was Melville's original title, but he changed it. Uh-huh. And the change never got to the publisher in England.
Interesting.
But they left out the last chapter, which, you know, this spoiler alert, this is where Ishmael grabs onto a piece of wood and saves himself from this wreckage of a ship. But the way the book ended was Ishmael's dead. Ishmael's gone down with the ship. Everybody's gone down. Mm. And so how do you write a book with a narrator who's, you know. Anyway, the English reviews said it's a mediocre book. And this was a book Melville was certain was get him out of debt, make him the book that we know it is today, you know, crowning achievement of American literature. It just didn't get out of the very influential English reviews. He got a corrected copy here, a second and a third edition, but the third edition was the last 600 copies in a warehouse in Brooklyn burned down, and that was it. So it was a huge disappointment. His next
was a disappointment to him.
Well, I think he knew he had written a masterpiece,
But in the rest of his life, would he be recognized the way he is today?
Not at all. Hmm. He was, almost unknown. His wife was working hard after his death in 1891 to keep a flicker of a flame of alive. There was a small following in the UK, much smaller here in the US. And then the early 1900s, that little spark with other writers who wrote unconventionally, like D.H. Lawrence and T.S. Eliot and Gertrude Stein, people were ready for this kind of novel, and it was rediscovered, and all of a sudden, then they rediscovered all his other work, and then Billy Budd came. They found Billy Budd. It had not been published until 1924.
Wow.
And so that all of us, you know, this 5 years of excitement about Melville, and then now we see the Melvilles in cartoons and the New Yorkers and constant references to Moby Dick and the White Whale in Melville.
Yeah.
That wasn't the case.
But it wasn't appreciated, basically, right, for, sounds like, 50 to 60 years.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So it's too bad that Melville wouldn't have known that. But I guess that's the way that true artists end up a lot of times. I think of, artwork, music, things like that. Sometimes those things aren't appreciated for generations until someone rediscovers them.
That's what my hope is with this book. Mm-hmm. It'll be discovered in 100 years. And go, wow.
I hope you're right. I hope they discover it sooner than that.
Yeah,
though,
me
John.
Too.
John Dixon's my guest here this morning, author of Herman Melville in the Berkshires. And this is 89.7 WTBR-FM, Morning Drive here. We're coming up to our top of the hour break where we will do our station ID and thank our underwriters and other things. And we'll do that get back to part two here with John Dixon this morning talking about his book. I do want to hear a little bit about his poetry and the connection to the Civil War, which, again, you know, sometimes when you're reading books like this, you have to place yourself into that time period where, what was happening. That was their reality, right? We're reading it as history, but that was their reality. They were living that day to day. And so you almost have to put yourself into that to really more thoroughly understand. I don't know if it's ever possible to completely understand what someone went through in their life while they were doing some great work like this. I don't know. What's your thought on that?
Well, I often have this discussion with my wife and friends, you know, what period would you like to go back to and for a day? And
yeah.
It's always for a day because issues like health And just like you say, transportation and communication, you'd much rather be living today. But, you know, it occurred to me, and it shouldn't have been taken long, but it occurred to me everybody walked back then. You know, what was unusual about Melville walking? You know, Melville walked to the post office. He rode to the post office every day or daily to get his mail. It was part of his routine. Mm-hmm. But also part of his routine was waking up in the morning and going for a walk just to clear his head before he sat down to write. And I think that clearing your head aspect of walking works for all of us. This is what we love. And you know, I've had a couple of people who read the book say, this book makes me want to go out and take a walk.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't do that enough.
Clearly.
And you know, one difference is, and I really have never liked walking with earphones and listening to a podcast, is because I like to be alone in my thoughts. Mm-hmm. And they were always alone in their thoughts. But Melville walked differently than me. And I understand that because he's so observant. I walk for exercise. I walk to clear my head, and as did he. But he would saunter and walk, and he would look around him, whereas I'm just looking into the roots to make sure I'm not going to stumble.
Yeah.
But, you know, he would stop. He said to friends of his that he would stop and pat the trees. And I write in there, that sounds borderline crazy, you know. But I'm sure what he was doing was feeling the texture of the tree and trying to tuck away, can this be useful in some writing that I have?
Looking for inspiration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's another, I mean, you talk about the times. What he needed, he didn't have electricity, he didn't have computers, but what he needed was paper. And so he lived in this county that produced paper. And
right.
So there's a famous journey of his with his family. He went over to the Crane Paper Mill in Dalton and bought paper in January of 1851, right after he moved in. And he turned that into a story later on. And it's a wonderful story about, it's called The Daughters of Tartarus, about these women who are working in the paper mill. But it's wonderful, too, the way he describes the sled going over the snow, through the ravines, getting to Dalton. He didn't call it Dalton, but he also bought paper and Lee and take his family here and there. So he's writing about the area.
Yeah, so all those Berkshire connections, which makes it fascinating for us here. John Dixon is my guest on Morning Drive, 89.7 WTBR-FM, talking about his new book, Herman Melville in the Berkshires. We'll be right back after this short break and talk more with John about this fascinating topic, Melville. You may not know as much as you would like to know. If you read this book, you would know a heck of a lot more. So we'll be right back after this. Stick around.
Stay tuned for more Morning Drive here on WTBR-FM.
Pittsfield Community Radio, 89.7 WTBR-FM Pittsfield, 88.1 WSBR Lee.
Support for WTBR comes from Greylock Federal Credit Union, proud to support high school arts and sports programs to help our community thrive. Greylock Federal, with locations throughout the Berkshires and online at greylock.org.
And from UCP of Western Massachusetts, the Northern Berkshire Early Intervention Program is now accepting applications for an occupational therapist to support child development, empower families, and change futures. 2026 graduates welcome to apply. Apply today at ucpwma.org.
Will you be an angel for our WTBR DJs? Every day our DJs are cold, hungry, sad, and lonely, and they are crying out for help. For only 30 cents per day, WTBR can provide them with clean studios, microphones, audio board, and much, much more. Go to WTBRFM.com and click the donate button and become a friend of WTBR. For only $8.97 per month, you can put some smiles on these faces. WTBR, for the love of radio.
Want more confidence using technology? PCTV offers free classes to help you navigate the internet, protect your privacy, and use your devices with ease. Whether you're a beginner or need a refresher, we've got you covered. Sign up today. Call 413-445-4234 or visit pittsfieldtv.org. Empower yourself with digital skills because everyone deserves to stay connected. Brought to you by PCTV and the Alliance for Digital Equity, keeping communities connected.
Welcome to Beyond, a one-hour program of science fiction, fantasy, and adventure. I'll be your host, Beverly Prentice. Listen in every Saturday morning at 8 a.m. My email is beyond3x5@gmail.com.
Support for WTBR comes from Berkshire Community College. Free community college for any Massachusetts resident without a bachelor's degree at BCC. Find out more at berkshirecc.edu. And from Sandrini Awnings and Home Improvement, providing awnings and canopies in Western Massachusetts. Retractable awnings, retractable screen, gutter and gutter protection systems, commercial awnings and screen rooms, customized solutions available. Online at sandrini.com.
Radio for people who used to love radio. Welcome back. WTBR.
And now back to the morning drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
Yes, welcome back to Morning Drive on 89.7 WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio. Sean Sayre here with you on April 30th, a Thursday morning. Welcome to the show. It's about 8:06, and we thank you for being here this morning, listening, as always, watching us maybe on Access Pittsfield Channel 1301 or on the PCTV Select app. And, of course, welcoming our friends in Lee, Lennox, and Stockbridge on 88.1 WSBR. We are going to be on part two here of our interview with John Dixon. He has authored the new book, Herman Melville in the Berkshires, and we're chatting with him about Melville and his connection to Pittsfield and the Berkshires and how that is all woven through his writing and his, certainly Moby Dick and other works that he did throughout his life. Fascinating to hear more about Melville. First, let's get to our weather forecast one more time here this morning and see what we have on tap today.
And now back to the morning drive on WTBR-FM, Pittsfield Community Radio.
And that's not the right one, but we'll try that again. Here's the weather.
Weather. WTBR radar weather for the Pittsfield area. Rest of tonight, rain. Near steady temperature in the mid-40s. South wind 5 to 10 miles per hour with gusts up to 25 miles per hour. Chance of rain 90%. Thursday, mostly cloudy. Showers likely, mainly in the morning. Cooler with highs in the mid-50s. South wind 5 to 10 miles per hour with gusts up to 20 miles per hour, becoming west in the afternoon. Chance of rain 60%. Thursday night, mostly cloudy with a chance of showers in the evening, then partly cloudy after midnight. Lows in the upper 30s. Northwest wind 5 to 10 miles per hour with gusts up to 20 miles per hour. Chance of rain 30%. Weather forecasts for WTBR-FM are provided by the National Weather Service.
All right, there you have it. A little bit of a gray morning out there, a little drizzle for you, but not a bad morning. And we've got a little bit of cool weather coming over the next couple days, and it'll probably get nice again right after the weekend, as it always does. Morning Drive here on 89.7 WTBR-FM. And John Dixon, thanks again for joining me this morning, talking about Herman Melville and the new book.
Great to be here with you, Sean.
So we were talking about the effect of the Civil War on Melville. So his last 3 years here in Pittsfield and the Berkshires, as a resident anyway, was during a very tumultuous time here in the country. How did that affect Melville? How did that affect his writing? And what kinds of things did he do in response to knowing what was going on in the country at the time?
Well, it was kind of all-consuming, as you can imagine, for everywhere in the country. Mm-hmm. He had family members who were sailors and soldiers.
By that time, he was, what, around 40 years old?
He would have been 40 at the time. But he was he read the newspapers. He would and followed the news. And he was an abolitionist, but he was, when he wrote about it, he wrote about it almost metaphorically.
How do you mean?
Well, he wrote a story about a mutiny on a slave ship
okay.
while he was living here before the Civil War. And It's a wonderful story. Benito Cereno, probably his most important short story. And it unfolds as a mutiny that you don't really realize that a mutiny had taken place of slaves. But I think the metaphor was people don't realize they see this scene of slaves interacting, enslaved people interacting with their masters, and they imagine one thing, but something else is really going on. Mm. There's another short story he wrote before the Civil War about Arrowhead. It's called I and My Chimney. And it's about a dispute between a husband and a wife over the central fireplace. And there is a central fireplace in Arrowhead.
Right.
And
for people who haven't been to Arrowhead, I would definitely encourage you to do so. It's probably opening up for the year fairly soon, right? We're getting into May.
It opens May 16th.
Yeah. The window that you described on that second floor, everybody needs to go there and look out that window and look at the desk and get the feeling for what Herman Melville was looking at while he was inspired to write Moby Dick.
And you do get a good sense there of this man who's writing in a house full of family, children, and sisters and mother, cramped in there, and he's trying. He's carved out space for him to write, and there's just this. You can imagine 8 or 9 other people in the house while he's trying to work.
And it's not that big of a house.
It's not a huge house, not like the Mount or some of these other writers' houses around. But it's a sizable house, and he made it work. Although he took the biggest room just for himself and his study, because I think he had so much stuff. But the chimney story, this dispute between the husband and the wife, people have written that that's about the coming of the Civil War, the house divided, and. I don't see it, but other people read that into the story.
That's interesting.
This tradition versus non-tradition in an argument that, and he doesn't use the term the house divided, but it certainly was in the story a house divided. Mm. But then when the Civil War started, and right before it started, Lincoln's election, he has started writing poetry, and he starts writing poetry about battles. And he publishes it after the war, Battle Pieces, it's called. But the first poem is called Musings, and he sees it as the whole country comes to see what's lying ahead. But then what happens in Pittsfield and around the nation is there are soldiers who are being recruited, and there are camps around Pittsfield, and he sees it on his way into town, these training camps, and he writes about those. And he takes his son to go watch the soldiers train, and he writes about that in his stories, in his poetry. And then two other poems, one of which is wonderful, is he writes about going to the telegraph office on North Street. And the whole poem is about people jockeying, trying to read the latest news from the front.
That's where they would have gotten it when it came right into the telegraph office.
That's where they would have gotten it, and the only place. And they had family members who are soldiers and are away, and they want to see if there's any news. And then he writes another wonderful poem called "The College Colonel," and this is when the return of the Massachusetts regiment, the Berkshire regiment that comes back from the fighting right around Vicksburg, they come back. They drag themselves, along the streets. They've been fighting these in Louisiana, and the college colonel is the Colonel Bartlett of Bartlett Avenue, who's wounded and has lost a leg, and he's leading his soldiers. And
wasn't he the colonel that went back multiple times after he was injured?
Unbelievable story.
Right? Yeah,
he was injured. He had his arm in a sling and had been a leg amputated, and he was riding the horse, and he had written down, there's pain so much in my arm, they should just take it, but they didn't. He saved his arm, and after that, he re-enlisted. He ended up as a prisoner of war after that, and got out and re-enlisted again.
I heard a story about something about him being strapped to the horse so he could go back into battle. Is that the same guy?
Probably. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there's another. He was not alone of amputees fighting on officers in the Civil War on both sides. Mm-hmm. But Melville writes this very beautiful, moving poem of seeing these soldiers who had gone off, you know, so fresh and proud and ready for the fight and come back just beaten down. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what were they? He tried to get inside their minds. Mm-hmm. So he's writing this poetry about the war as it's seen from Pittsfield.
Yeah. And was that poetry published somewhere at the time? What was the outlet for that?
It was published, Battle Pieces. It did not make a big splash.
Yeah.
He wrote a poem, for example, on the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, but Walt Whitman's poem Longfellow's poems were much more famous than his.
Mm-hmm.
People say his poetry was not as good. His prose was more poetic, and his poetry was more forced. But I have found a few of his poems really moving and a good insight into into the way he looked at. He wasn't, He was a patriot, but he wasn't, trying to show the Union cause, we're winning, but he really tried to enter soldiers' minds, and he actually went to the front at one point.
Did he really?
He went down to Virginia. He got permission to go with his brother as a writer, and he ended up in Virginia at one of the, they allowed him to come close to the front.
It's an interesting fact. Yeah. I didn't realize that about him.
Yeah.
Yeah. John Dixon, my guest here this morning, if you're just joining us, we're talking about Herman Melville and John's new book, Herman Melville and the Berkshires. I want to explore a little bit about his relationship with Nathaniel Hawthorne, because that is also a storied connection for the Berkshires. And I think you mentioned in the first half that Hawthorne was here a much shorter time than Melville was, but they still had a deep bond between the two authors, right? Explore that a little bit.
Sure. Hawthorne came in March of the year 1850 when Melville ended up here. Hawthorne had just published a Scarlet Letter and was a little derogatory about the people of Salem, and so he left Salem, and somebody said, why don't you move out to my rented cottage out in Lenox, Massachusetts? Mm. And so Hawthorne had been here. And Hawthorne was here in the summer when Melville came up here, and a man in Stockbridge put together a group of writers who came up and were in the area for the Berkshires, in the area of the Berkshires for the summer, including Melville's neighbor at the time, Oliver Wendell Holmes. Hmm. But this man invited them all to a hike, really. I mean, I don't know for sure if it said come for a hike, come for dinner was probably what he said, but they ended up going on a hike. So it's interesting that Melville and Hawthorne met first while walking, and they were walking up Monument Mountain in Great Barrington, and I call it America's most famous literary hike, and we reenacted it at the Historical Society every year on the anniversary of the hike.
And where does it start?
So the hike started right at, now you can hike up Monument Mountain at the base of it, but because the loggers were logging so much, you could probably ride your carriage up much further.
Huh.
And there's a little debate about which side of the mountain they started and how they got up.
Okay.
But what's not a debate, because there were 10 people on the hike, all of them writers but one, and something magical happened on that walk that they all wrote about. They all got things wrong, too, because there's no real good list of who was actually on it, but they were writing about who was on it. But
so you have to sort of piece it together.
Piece it together.
To figure it out.
But it was wonderful. You could just imagine these 10 brilliant writers, historians, editors, agents climbing the mountain. One of them said, we were rhyming and climbing, rambling and scrambling up the mountain. And the repartee of these people going up the mountain was really would have been wonderful to witness, and we do only in their words. But this is where Hawthorne, who was 15 years older than Melville, and Bowdoin College graduate, a real intellectual transcendentalist, meets this sixth grade dropout, and they connect. And what was it that connected? And I think what was Melville's charisma on the hike. they write about a storm coming up, and everybody retreated to a small cave, except for Melville, who jumped out and showed people how you bring down sails in the middle of the Pacific, in the middle of a storm, you know, flailing his arm, charismatically telling this story. And I could just imagine Hawthorne's mouth dropping, jaw, like, wow, this guy knows how to. And so Hawthorne was a bit of an introvert. He invited Melville back to his house in Lenox, and Melville was, yeah, I'm coming. And they connected, and their conversations were at a different level. And Hawthorne writes in one story that he wrote that summer, Mr. Melville came over and we continued our ontological conversations. Wow. Meaning of life conversations. And then Melville writes, Hawthorne wrote, we talked about time and eternity, this world and the next, all things possible and impossible. And it was Melville who said, I want to come over and continue the ontological discussions. So they're talking meaning of life. And I think that those conversations, often while walking, they would walk down to Stockbridge Bowl and back, walk around. They would go over to Shaker Village. And
right. Returning to the theme of the book, right? Again, wandering and walking and all the things that come from that.
Absolutely. And so I think Melville had this draft of a book about whaling. And these philosophical conversations about the meaning of life, he thought, no, I want to write and use this whale as a metaphor of searching and obsessively trying to find meaning in life. And this is the metaphor, I believe. But, he has so much in there.
Do you think there's some Hawthorne influence in Moby Dick?
Absolutely. Yeah. Melville was impressed with Hawthorne's, as a transcendentalist, they talk about their view of nature. Nature is almost to be worshipped. Hawthorne was a different. He wrote about the dark side, and so I think Melville was interested in this aspect that Hawthorne in their discussions. One interesting thing was, I think Melville did all the talking, and just. Hawthorne was more a therapist than just listening and maybe interjecting a word here and there and would set Melville off like you just set me off talking. not that I'm Melville at all.
He wound him up and let him go, right?
Yeah.
That's what we say.
Yeah. and they continued these conversations for as long as he was writing Moby Dick. Over the course of the next year, after he bought Arrowhead, I think one of the reasons he bought Arrowhead was he wanted to continue those conversations and live in the area and be near Hawthorne.
After he left Arrowhead, how was the house itself saved? How was it preserved? Because basically it's roughly in the same condition that it was all throughout the year. It must have passed to different families and somehow then became what it is now.
So... a good question, Sean. He couldn't sell it to anybody. He was not making it financially. He sold off half the land. And then finally, his brother agreed to swap houses. His brother had a second house in New York City.
Okay.
And his brother used this as a summer retreat. And it was in his brother's family until the 1920s.
Oh, wow.
So they preserved it. And fortunately for Herman, he could come back when he wanted to visit, and he did.
Interesting.
There were about five families that owned it from that time in the 1920s to 1975 when the Historical Society bought the house. They made changes, a lot of changes.
Yeah. as many people do with an older house.
Yes.
You want to adapt it, make it useful for you in your time.
They tore off a lot of the, what Melville had called shanties of L's. He had added on the back a kitchen and a wood cutting place. And they put in, you know, a major extension with bedrooms and other rooms. And they changed some of the other things. When the Historic Society bought it, we had to redo the study. We had to open up some of the fireplaces. They had put a picture window in. We took it out. Uh-huh. They had taken the porch off. We put the porch back on. Uh-huh. So the Historic Society did an awful lot to try to get it to where what it would have looked like when Melville was living there.
Interesting, yeah. And then that's been over 50 years now since it's been owned by the Historical Society.
Yeah.
So, John Dixon, tell us in the 5 minutes or so we've got left here the process of writing a book and getting it published and all the stuff that we don't know about when we pick up the book and we read it. We don't get some of that experience. So let us in behind the scenes a little bit about what it's like to do that.
Okay. And I'm not an expert or...
But you've gone through the process.
But I've gone through the process, and I actually had a publisher, so it wasn't self-published, but it was something I wanted. I realized that there was a connection between Melville and what he was looking at, whether it was Greylock or Balance Rock or Ashley Lake. And I started writing it, and I wanted to get it off my brain, like
the way that Melville wanted to. Right?
Well, I hesitate to say that,
but it's the same process, right?
Yeah. You have a kernel of an idea, and you know, the more I read, and there's a 2-volume biography of Herman Melville written by a scholar named Herschel Parker. He painstakingly went through all the letters and it was very helpful because, for example, his sister wrote a journal in 1851 of all the trips they took, the family. Oh, they went off over here on August 7th, over here they went back to Shaker Village.
Wow, very highly detailed.
Yeah, so that helped an awful lot in the writing. And then the more I read, and I read this book, I have Melville's collected works on a Kindle, so I could, search Balance Rock. Hmm. And all of a sudden, it comes up. I could search. And some searches didn't come up, but it was easier. For example, I searched.
But all the places that we've walked, Balance Rock, Pontusic Lake, places like that we know now in our modern era are places that he might have set foot also.
And he wrote a poem about, I digress, because he wrote
Still
a poem about Pontusic Lake.
Right.
Anyway, I'll get back to Pontusic Lake because we live in that part of the city.
Right.
But so I wanted it. I got it on the computer. I was making sure I was saving it left and right, you know, so I wouldn't lose it. And then I just pitched it myself. I had written a book with this organization before on the mills in Berkshire County, and it's a local history publishing company, and they. Within 3 days, said, "Yeah, we're interested."
That's great.
And then the process began of, you know, whether it's signing the contract and, you know, getting the draft together, them editing it, getting the pictures, getting the rights to the, making sure I had the rights to the pictures. The people at the library were very helpful,
wonderful.
And at the Historical Society.
Mm. Helps to have friends in good places there, right? And you didn't have to have a wife or 3 sisters rewriting things for you?
No, but my wife was my first reader. She went through it. But they had a great editor, and I do believe that editors make the book. I made a number of mistakes, and they would have been totally embarrassing. So I'm thankful for that. Yeah. And then it was just a waiting process. Yeah. And then you go through the whole... author's questionnaire of marketing and
sounds like such a long process, but fulfilling at the end of the day, and you have a product that you can be proud of. And I'll just hold this up again. This is Herman Melville in the Berkshires, written by John Dixon. It is available in all your normal outlets, I'm sure. And good luck with everything regards to the book. And of course, you'll go to Arrowhead. You can see John there. You might actually get a tour.
Yeah, and I'm giving a book talk there on it May 16th, the opening day. But
great.
There are plenty of very good tour guides. Melville has a...
we're running out of time, John. We got to say goodbye, unfortunately. Last 5 seconds. Thank you for being here. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Sean.
Right. Take care, everybody. We'll see you tomorrow.